Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio. Today's show is called My Lion Eyes. Audio, video, image enhancement expert Doug Carter discusses tampered evidence and industry secrets. So now, without any further ado, let's jump right into our hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome everybody. To this edition of Crime and Science Radio, we have a fascinating show today. This is one of my favorite topics. In the forensic investigation world, everybody out there has seen where images and audio files and how they play into cases, and you see it on TV all the time, a blurred ATM image, et cetera, and how it gets enhanced so that it actually becomes useful evidence. And today we have one of the experts in that field, Doug Carter, who is an audio, video, and image enhancement and authentication expert. The type of cases that he has worked on cover the spectrum, some of which you might expect and some of which you might not, but everything from, you know, train and air crashes to arson, murder, rape, 911 calls, excessive force, industrial accidents, kind of interesting there, slips and falls where people fake things, theft, custody cases. It goes on and on. So really looking forward to this. Doug, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. As Doug said, it's a great topic. So let's start out with letting our audience know, what exactly does an audio, image, and video enhancement expert do?
Well, provides clarity to the subtle details and exposes the tampering that may have occurred with the recording. For example, when someone whispers or places their hand over a microphone or even covers or mutes the microphone electrically, the audio is still being recorded. It's just incredibly quiet, and it can be amplified. Or when a scene is too dark or captured only in a reflection, those details can be amplified. And as a natural extension of doing this type of work, the expert can detect if a recording has been edited or otherwise manipulated. In short, we're the triers of truth, and we all work for the evidence regardless of the hiring party.
Well, how did you get into this field? What started you off on this path?
Well, credit actually goes to my sister, who in the 90s would send me every possible humorous image that she could find on the Internet. Some of them, and I'm sure we've all been recipients of these kinds of emails, and you look at some and you see a shark jumping in front of the Golden Gate Bridge to attack a helicopter, you know it's fake, but others may not be so obvious. And rather than guessing whether they were real or not, I started to wonder if it was possible to tell. A program was out called Virtual Dub, a piece of free software that some of your listeners may have experience with. And I began working with that program, and there were a very rich collection of filters that were available. Then a scripting language called AVI Synth came out, also free. And working with the online collaboration groups, I began developing tools to actually find not only methods to enhance the details, but now determine the legitimacy of those details. During this time, my income was coming from working with system integrators, and they were providing me with hands-on time with audio and video surveillance, as well as being trained by the factory reps who would come out. So I started to write software to automate the process, and eventually I became sort of a secret subcontractor for enhancement companies, first locally, then eventually around the world, where they would do the easy work and they would send the tougher stuff to me. I think partially because I was underpriced. Business was really good. I never had to advertise, and eventually led to free software that I've developed that I give away to everyone. In fact, one of them is called Video Cleaner. There's a link that I know you guys are posting with the show. And what makes this job real exciting is I receive cases from around the world. I mean, spanning every jurisdiction of both civil and criminal issues.
Well, you know, one of the things you deal with is whether images, video, audio, or still images have been tampered with. Is this really a common problem? Do people try to do this stuff to get away with crimes all the time, or is it something that's not that common?
Well, I will tell you, I process over 1,000 cases a year. And it's not uncommon for me to discover file tampering, even when the attorney is unaware of its occurrence. The most common issue is when a recording is stopped and restarted, especially with audio files. It usually comes up because the attorney's client has a different recollection of what was said than what was on the recording. And upon further investigation, we'll find that the recording was stopped. We won't know what wasn't captured, but we'll be able to prove that there was a pause. And during that pause, it is questionable as to what occurred. Was there any coaching going on? So it is actually a fairly common problem, less so with video, but now that's changing as technology is advancing.
Well, what are the most common types that you've run across? I mean, what kinds of things? Let's just take them one at a time, like audio and video and then images. What do you see in each of those arenas that is the most common tampering that you deal with and see in your practice?
Well, I'd actually break it into three classes. There's the intentional, which is kind of obvious. It's a willful act that results in creating a new reality. For example, an investigator uses creative editing and frame removal to show an injured party walking faster than was reality. However, in a case I actually had that had this, at some portions of the surveillance, an intersection could be seen at the distance. And when you amplify the light from the signal, even though that signal is very faint, you're able to now time how long that signal takes. And if someone goes out to the field and actually times how long the signal really should take, you can compare that and prove that the video is not playing at its natural speed. With audio, I had a case that involved incriminating statements being made during a phone call. I was able to prove that there had been edit splicing of removed speech and replicated utterances that also created a new reality. Depending on your point of view, placing your hand over a microphone to hide a conversation is also a type of intentional tampering. The other one is unintentional, where it's just improper recovery of or conversion of the data may go through an inaccurate process. You may have a cell phone video of a fight that shows no signs of content manipulation, but the hidden data within it could denote GPS coordinates that don't make sense. Or even when there's no provable signs of content manipulation, you can still find that just the way the video was handled or the audio file was handled, how it was converted, that creates an unintentional tamper. And then you have just things that are caused by the local environment. You play a video or an audio file on your computer, and it may play slightly different or look different because of your monitor than it might on someone else's. Even your sound card and your speakers can affect the way it sounds or the headphones that are being used. So there are types and different levels of manipulation or tampering, and they all can lead to a different understanding of what the reality was.
Just to kind of follow up on that, so I think most of us have probably had the experience of where you would play something on one device and get one sort of sound quality, and then, as you say, either listening to it through headphones or through a speaker. But you're talking about things that are happening within the actual file itself, right?
Correct. That you have both actions that are done to the file, and then you also have the effects that the software or the hardware that's playing back the audio or video creates a different. I'll give you an example. Take a picture that you take and you print it out. if you print it on photo paper, it's going to look different than if you print it on regular paper, and even different printers having different types of ink and different resolution are going to print those pictures, and they won't look identical. And the question is, which one's accurate? Which one is the reality?
So does manipulating, let's say, recorded files require special training?
Well, about 50 years ago, you had to be a skilled artist with a paintbrush. 20 years ago, you had to have, you know, be a specialized software engineer. Today, it's inexpensive software, and it does all the work for you. I know that you can use software called InPainting. That's the process that Hollywood uses if there's a fire hydrant or other object they want to get rid of. And you can use that to remove unwanted people from your vacation videos. There are websites that do this for next to nothing, and the software is really inexpensive. Photoshop has a feature called Content Aware that lets you relocate anyone or anything in a photo, and it takes care of the lighting and shadows for you. Free programs like Audacity can rearrange audio content and create a new master recording.
Wow.
So did the problems that have arisen, because obviously some of this can be used with criminal intent, so did those problems originate with the age of the computer, or do they go back before we had computers?
I personally thought that this really had started with the computer age. The more I started to do this, I mean, I realized that as a society, we believe things are true just because they're generally accepted by the public. But and a couple of things have come to light. Hitler had official photos altered to remove people that he no longer supported. We all should probably remember the Islamic newspaper that removed Hillary Clinton from the official photo of her sitting in the war room during the raid on Bin Laden's hideout. The Los Angeles Times added a non-existent crowd to their published photo of the 1989 Tiananmen Square protest in Beijing, and that was quite embarrassing. There's a famous portrait of Abraham Lincoln that was created after the Civil War that hung on the walls of almost every public classroom in America, mine included. And it was actually Lincoln's head painted onto John Calhoun's body with the words, "Sovereignty of the States changed to Proclamation of Freedom." There are thousands of documented historical forgeries and possibly millions more yet to be discovered. A file tampering, I figure, probably dates back to the Stone Age, when I can imagine a caveman who was using a drawing to record their lives and turned a cowardly moment into a heroic encounter.
Artistic license, right? Even on the cave walls.
Exactly.
Well, let me ask you that. Following up on that, the Lincoln photo you talked about, how exactly did they do that? Did they just cut and paste and re-photograph it, or did they just cut and paste and nobody could see the paste lines? I mean, what did they...
What
was the mechanism for doing that? I mean, now the computers, you know, like you said, a push of a button can do it, but how did they do it back then and make people believe that it was really the photograph?
I don't recall if they ever figured out which artist it was that did it, but they did. They found the photograph, because there weren't very many heroic photographs of Abraham Lincoln. He just wasn't one to pose for those as much as others. So they took a photo that they had from a portrait sitting he had done, and this artist, again, I don't know if the name's known, painted it on and created this at the request of, I don't know if it was Congress or just an official, so that there would be something to show this heroic moment in our history.
Well, and just kind of also, I think I've seen where playing with perspective and some of the things that just happen almost with as people started taking photographs, when you go back almost to the beginning of anybody photographing anything, there were people who learned you could fool the camera. I guess that just comes in with our, you know, being cousins to monkeys somewhere along the line. We've been fooling with things from the beginning, it seems.
Exactly.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, it is the ease in which that it can be done today is astounding. It really requires no skills whatsoever. I mean, they teach it to the later years in grade school to students now to be able to do it, to create collages and other things. And suddenly now shadows make sense, lighting makes sense, and it becomes a very real item. It's very tough these days to trust what you see or hear anymore.
That's true. Well, let's flash forward to today now. With modern technology and the modern photos and digital stuff, how can you tell if a picture is not what it purports to be, that it is fake? What are the basic things that you look for if someone gives you a photograph and says, we don't believe this is a true representation? What do you look for? How do you approach that?
Well, my favorite tool of them all, it takes advantage of the fact that videos are unique in that a significant amount of details have to be squeezed out to remove and reduce that file size. And the software tries, whatever software you're using, tries to do this so that it's eliminating things that the human eye isn't very good at being able to distinguish. Let me give you an example why this is necessary. You think about a DVD. That's 4 gigabytes and holds 90 minutes worth of video. That's already compressed and has some loss there. But now imagine instead of saving 90 minutes, you're trying to save 30 days from 16 cameras 24 hours a day. There's no way you're going to get that to fit on a 1 terabyte drive or a 500 gigabyte drive without squeezing away more information. And we all experience this when we try and save an image as a JPEG. You've probably had a slider that you can adjust to choose how much you compress it, and if you overcompress it, it looks terrible. Well, we can actually use that to tell if a picture's been altered. The way the process works, and this works with video or images, is every time you resave an image or a video, and you can try this with a JPEG. You can just take a JPEG, load it up, resave it at extreme compression, and repeat this 20 times in a row, just resaving with the result. And you're going to end up with a pretty close to gray blob in front of you. Each time you save an image with this compression, there are fewer details to get rid of. So the first time, a lot gets squeezed out. Next time, less. Next time, less. Well, if an object has been added, like a handgun, or maybe it's been removed, or an object's been relocated in an image or a video, when you save it, that newly placed item is going to undergo more changes than the rest of the scene because it's going through the first compression while everything else is going through the second. So the secret now is you take this altered image and you compress it one more time. And again, the newly placed items are still going to change more than everything else. If you subtract those two versions from each other, the differences will stand out, and suddenly a hard-to-tell object becomes real obvious. The process is called error level analysis when it's an image and video error level analysis when it's a video. And actually, at my website, forensicprotection.com, I actually provide all the software and the do-it-yourself instructions so anyone can do this with any video that you suspect. You can just run it through this process. It's quick, it's easy, and instantly know if something's been added or removed from the scene. Now, with images, there's actually websites you can go to. If you just type in error level analysis, you'll find them, and there'll be a link in with this show's description. For one of those websites, where you can just upload the image and it'll give you that report right away. It's a graphical image, but it makes it easy to tell what's been changed. I had a case where a video showed a zoomed image. And the only way you can get a zoomed image when a DVR, a digital video recorder, is recording is if either someone is controlling that pan, tilt, zoom to have it happen, or there's sophisticated software on site that tracks people. And since the client didn't have either of those present at the on site, it was an after-the-fact post-production. In this particular case, it was someone holding a cell phone up to the playback screen and just recording a new reality.
Hmm. Well, in analyzing things, does it always take specialized software, or are there other things that you can use to determine if something's been tampered with, something more low-tech?
Obviously, software lets you go after the really sophisticated items, and it speeds up a lot of the process. But some tests just require a patient eye. For example, light always travels in a straight line until it passes through some substance that changes its course. As such, you can just take a ruler and a pen, take a picture and draw a straight line that passes through any point of any object and then the same point on the shadow that that object has. All of those lines should converge at a single point, even if that point is somewhere off the picture. Any lines that don't follow this rule will refer to a manipulated object worthy of further investigation. And even when software is required, it doesn't need to be expensive. Most of the programs out there cost less than $100, and some are free.
Now, so we were just talking about visual images to kind of switch to the audio. Can you use, are there methods, similar methods for, obviously not the shadow thing, but methods for audio recording that sort of rely on the physics, or are they handled differently?
It is actually a little different for audio. You have to understand the basics of how a microphone works. Audio is recorded by passing alternating current, direct current into a microphone, and then letting the audio signal return as alternating current. And so you have this oscillation, and we've all seen it. It looks sort of like a heartbeat when you're watching a visual representation of an audio pattern. And that pattern is a graphical representation of the electrical impulses that are going to make that sound. So the mathematical average of all those oscillations over a given time range should stay consistent. And if it is changing, it should change and drift in a very smooth pattern. That's called the bias. It's called the DC bias line. And you, so we expect to see that this is slowly going to change. It's a little hard to tell with the eye because you're comparing one minute to another, and it, how are you going to average out these millions of bits of data? But the software can do this easily. And if you start to see, instead of it changing gradually, it suddenly changes, that's an indication that some audio was removed, or that audio was added if it, it jumps and then jumps back to sort of that smooth pattern you had before. Another example is right now in the room that everyone's sitting in, there's electrical outlets, and those electrical outlets are giving off a 60 hertz signal. That means 60 times a second the sound wave is oscillating as an electrical impulse. It is so faint you can't hear it. You can put your ear right up to the electrical outlet, you're not going to hear it, but it's still being picked up by the electronics that are recording our voices right now. So in the background of the recording of this session, assuming the microphone picks up as low as 60 hertz, and most do, there's going to be an incredibly faint trace of that perfect 60 hertz signal. So if we follow that, if we have software that follows that perfect wave, like a surfer going over waves, and suddenly it drops off at one spot, that's an indication of a tamper. And if there's two of these waves, one fainter than another, that's an indication of a dub. Several years ago, I had a case where there was a number of gunshots that exceeded what a witness remembers hearing. And upon deeper inspection, I found that two of the gunshots were exact duplicates of earlier occurrences. Everything was a match, including the background sounds and the exact timing between the seconds of the shots, even when measured in millionths of a second. So all of these in audio are incredible resources to be able to tell if something has been tampered with.
Well, that's amazing. I think, you know, that is something we forget because we tend to focus on whatever the sound of interest to us is, you know, and forget that this is all on a really a kind of a canvas of its own. So can a recording be traced back to its origin?
This is actually fun because this is like being a detective in trying to trace something back. The power plants around the nation, in fact, we're on a whole North American grid, so the entire continent, there are power generators that go online and offline because you really can't store electricity effectively. So the demand is constantly changing. Factory comes online, offline, it's going to change the demand. So this means that that perfect 60 hertz signal that's in our wall outlet isn't exactly perfect. It's going to drift, maybe by a millionth of a percent, but it'll be a little bit faster, a little slower. Well, power plants have been recording this data for decades. So it is possible to take a recording, measure the frequency of that 60 hertz signal, again, to the millionth of a percent, and then compare it to the stored records, and you now know when and where this recording was done. You can nail it down to a very specific geographic region and a very specific time range. And if those facts don't line up with the facts of the case, you know it's been tampered.
Well, we're going to take a short break here. Fascinating stuff, and we're going to be back on the flip side with Doug Carner again, and we're going to talk more about audio, video, and sound. Stay with us.
Hello, everybody, and I'd like to talk to you about some upcoming releases that are out now. Arthur Barbara Petty delivers the first book in a new series called What Has Mother Done? The title itself suggests a riveting mystery wrapped up within a drama. Reviewers have agreed that Barbara penned a winner, so check out Amazon.com for more on What Has Mother Done? By Barbara Petty. Five gripping new mysteries await you from publisher Camel Press. Stealing the Golden Dream, Due for Discard, and Split to Splinters are just a few of the wonderful books being published by Camel Press. Check out all their titles by visiting camelpress.com. The Thriller Master is back with a sequel. Yes, David Morrell releases Inspector of the Dead, which brings back character Thomas De Quincey. Murder as a Fine Art was the first book and was listed on several of the top lists in 2014. Now experience more of 1850s London and Inspector of the Dead. Go to davidmorrell.net for more information on these and all of his books. Kensington Kills. Well, not really, but their books sure do. And author Lisa Jackson and M. William Phelps, A.J. Tana, and more deliver explosive action and intrigue with every page. Make sure you visit KensingtonBooks.com for more information on these and every title they have to offer, and you won't be sorry. Suspense Theater comes alive with Amon Kabachnik. His Blood on the Stage books bring readers a wealth of material for lovers of the stage, says the Los Angeles Times. Check out Where Stories Come Alive and visit Amon Kabachnik for more information on all six of these titles. And that's AmonKabachnik.com. A century-old tale leads to a fortune in bandit gold. That's the adventure that Jack Farrell faces in his latest adventure, Marietta Gold, by author William Nickel. This is the fourth book in the series. And visit William Nickel, that's 2Ks, EL.com for more information on this and the entire series. We'll be right back.
everybody after the break again with a fantastic episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio. Of course, today's show is called My Lying Eyes, Audio Visual Image Enhancement Expert Doug Carter discusses tampered evidence and industry secrets, and maybe he can get me untongue-tied. But now here are the hosts of your show again, Doug Lyle and Jan Burr.
Well, welcome back, everyone. I wanted to just follow up. Can you tell us a little more about, especially with the forensic implications or law enforcement implications for being able to trace a recording back to its origin?
Well, before the break, we were talking about how power plant signals can be used to come back to a time and a general vicinity for a recording. You can actually go back to a specific camera or audio recording because different cameras and different recorders are going to have different characteristics. I'm not only talking about between the models where you're thinking things like resolution or color depth, timing, light bouncing, signal noise ratios, and electrical issues. You can also have individual issues like wiring that is between the camera and the DVR that creates a unique signal. You can have defects in the camera that almost like the ballistics of a gun when you're trying to match the bore scratch marks on a bullet. Same way, you could match up and say these electrical characteristics match this, or the camera has a flaw in it, a dead pixel, for example, and be able to match that up exactly the same way and be able to say that's the camera that took this video. This proves that it is the same one. So there's a tremendous amount of additional information, even the fact that when they do the imagers inside of these cameras, there's a choice of even how to lay out the pattern because you think of red, green, blue, but remember, everything's binary. So there's actually red, green, green, blue. And where those two greens are in relation to each other on the imager can also narrow down which brand and model was used to record.
So what else can you decipher from metadata?
Well, so the metadata is going to give me some insight. It's going to provide some of those things I spoke of. I mean, first understand that metadata just means data about data. So I can get information like not only the resolution of what the video is and the color depth, but I can look at what was it set to be. So metadata can give me information about how the equipment was set up to record. It gives me the date and time of the recording, the settings that were applied, the manufacturer's make and model may be embedded into that metadata, the version number of the software that was used to save the recording, even the GPS. You may get all of this, you may get some of this. It all depends on what information the equipment manufacturer chooses to include in that particular model. I had a case that had a fight that took place in the hills of Los Angeles, and it's all captured on a cell phone. And the video comes back, I run the test, and it's inconclusive running the video error level analysis as to whether or not it's authentic or not. But they're claiming that there was more to the video, that something had been cut off at the end. Well, that's the hardest thing for these tests to tell, if anything's been trimmed off the end of it, because or off the beginning. I think it was the beginning in this case. They wanted the stuff that led up to it. And so when I analyzed it, I'm going through and I give them the report and I say I can't find any conclusive evidence and here's the metadata and here's the GPS coordinates of where it took place and this is the house that it indicates. And they're like, oh, wait a minute, that's not where this fight took place. This fight took place at this other location over here that's 4 miles away. Well, GPS is a fairly accurate item. I mean, it might be off by 50 feet. It's not going to be off by miles. So then they started to investigate what was significant about that address, and it turned out that one of the party to the case lived at that address, that exact address, and happened to be a video editor by profession.
just coincidentally, huh?
Right. So when they trimmed down the video, the software they used put in their current GPS coordinates when it updated the record.
Oh, wow.
Oops. Tilt. Well, is there any method of preventing tampering? Are there any recording gadgets that are like tamper-proof, or can someone always worm their way in there?
Well, there's two ways. First off, there's proprietary files. You've probably seen this. There's, especially in video surveillance, sometimes you'll get the video as an EXE, where it's the player and the video stream are all in this one file, or it'll have some weird extension that you're not able to play with anything that you've got. The downside to that, of course, is it can make any attempts to extract the video and video enhancement to be challenging. But the positive is, if it's truly a proprietary format, and the same is true with photographic images, then it prevents tampering, because unless that proprietary format has been cracked and someone has made software to write the file, because reading it's one thing, writing to it is another, and those are very closely guarded secrets by the manufacturer, then you can have the assurance of saying, okay, this file is accurate, and its own metadata will tell you when it was created. So you have, okay, I know this file was created on this date, this time, and its contents are true. Once a format gets cracked and you're able to write to it, manufacturers scramble to come up with another version. And there are people out there who try and crack these things just out of boredom, I think. So the other is that that any file, video, an audio recording, whatever it is, even a document, is a string of ones and zeros that the computer uses to reconstruct a more meaningful representation of that data. So that stream of data can be hashed into a unique serial number, and a hash value is that unique number. MD5 is the most common format that acts like a serial number or a fingerprint for that file. In fact, MD5 is so common, it's probably built into software you already own. You just may not have noticed it on the menu choice because you had no reason to use it. Any hash value program, no matter who makes it, if it's got MD5 on it, will calculate the exact same MD5 value. So you could use your program X, I could a year later use my program Y, and if the file hasn't been changed, our numbers are going to match up. And these serial numbers are long, and so they are unique to that file. And it provides an easy way for everyone to verify they're working on the same file. So when I receive a file, first thing I do is I do the hash value. And that way I don't have to have the chain of custody of my receiving the original. It stays in someone else's hands. Opposing counsel can run their own hash value, compare it up. Any other experts can do the same. And so it certifies even a non-proprietary file at that moment. Also, another thing you can do is people can take a video of them extracting the video. So as you're pulling the video off the DVR, you can have someone or yourself use the cell phone and record the action happening, and it becomes a document to show it was pulled off of this machine at this time in this manner. Now, MD5 is so accurate that there are trillions of trillion times more accurate than the most advanced DNA testing for comparing things. In fact, you have better odds of winning the Powerball lottery 4 times in a row than ever being able to change a file in such a way that it results in the same MD5 hash value. Now, for PC owners, a program that's the easiest to use is called Hash My Files. It's free. I love free software. And a link is going to be included with the description of this episode.
Hmm. Okay, cool. All right, my television and my cell phone are pretty cool, and they make pretty good pictures. So why are surveillance recordings so crappy?
There's a term called codec. It stands for compression, decompression. So if you ever hear of a video codec, that's what they're talking about. And it is that math formula to say, here's how you're going to squeeze out those details. Even in audio, if you think about MP3, a common audio format, that's a codec, and it squeezes out details. Now, a lot less gets squeezed out in audio than in video. In video, you may get a 100 times smaller file size. And you also can have issues where the resolution is shrunk. Remember, the goal here is you have a limited hard drive space. So you take that surveillance camera, which tends not to be high def, and then you shrink down the resolution because you're trying to conserve space on a hard drive, and then you use a codec that squeezes out a ton of defects, details. You're going to get defects. Those defects are noise. And so not only are you losing color and light, you now have this noise. And you've seen it when you've used a cheap camera and you've taken a video at night and you get those specks that appear, or you've just watched a low-quality video and there's like a wavy quality even to things that aren't supposed to be moving. That's all noise.
Now, is noise useful to you?
Well, actually, what's great about it is it's a leftover artifact from the compression. So it actually provides guidance to build back those lost details. You know, when you compress something down, there can be a tremendous number of iterations of what possible original created it. I can't take a license plate that is seen on a screen where each character only occupies a single dot of resolution and reconstruct the license plate from that single dot. But if I've got enough noise there, I can actually build back significant details because those are the clue to how it was compressed. And if I know how it was compressed, I can reverse most of it.
Interesting.
Well, I'm just wondering, what can be done to make an audio or video recording clearer? And you know, you're talking to someone who still hasn't figured out how not to make her dog's eyes look like they're vampires. it's always amazing to me to see, you know, sort of what can be started with and where you end up. So how does that work? How does that happen?
Well, you have a couple ways to go about it. The first is enhancement. Everyone knows the word, and unfortunately, it carries with it a certain connotation of manipulation, but it doesn't have to be. There's actually three types. You can do a restorative process where you're building back, and that's what I was talking about with the noise. You're just restoring back details that mathematically can be proven were there and were lost in the compression. You can also improve upon it. You can suppress noises while retaining details. An example is in audio enhancement, there's software that recognizes what a human voice sounds like. It's actually based on the same software when you do online banking and you're speaking to the computer. So it recognizes human speech and it says, okay, I'm going to elevate the volume of human speech and everything else I'm going to suppress. So that improves upon it. And the same applies with video. Objects can be recognized. Faces can be recognized just as your camera does when it automatically knows, oh, that's a human face, I need to focus on it. In fact, my smartphone can detect if the person's smiling or not. And the third one is emphasizing, where details like a traffic signal far in the distance can be emphasized, or like a fire. It's used. The video cleaner software has a function in it that helps when you're trying to figure the origin of a fire. And so this subtle change in temperature suddenly becomes a much more dramatic moment. In fact, you could actually take a high-res video of a person speaking, and if you emphasize the colors, you can now see the blood in there going through with each pulse, going through their face. And as they begin to lie, you'll see a much more dramatic red. And suddenly, a video of an interview becomes a lie detector.
Hmm. Wow. Now, so you mentioned earlier the word enhancement, and I think all of us have seen television shows. A CSI may show it actually going through a kind of lab, but we've also seen shows where someone just gives a verbal command to a computer, enhance, and magically the picture is sharpened up, or that's the way it seems. But is enhancement real or science fiction, especially sort of to the degree we're seeing it on dramas?
Well, first off, the speed in which it happens is questionable because it takes a lot of processing power, especially the restorative step. That one can take 24 hours to process 5 minutes of video, depending on the resolution. The emphasizing is the fast one, and it's often abused. That's the one just where you make details more obvious, but unfortunately, in doing so, you lose other details. The big issue is the amount of resolution increase you see. I mean, on these shows, they'll have where you see the reflection in someone's eye, you zoom in on it, and you can see the killer's face. Well, that's not possible. I mean, if that kind of enhancement was possible, you could take a Polaroid picture of the night sky, and you wouldn't need the Hubble telescope. So the reality is that if you can make out one of the characters on a license plate you can recover the whole plate. If you think you can make out a character, it could be a U, could be a V, but you're not sure, you're going to get a partial plate. And if you can't read that license plate, enhancement process isn't going to get you there either, unless the issue is it's just too dark, but the license plate otherwise would have been readable. That's where the reality of the technology is. With audio, actually, more can be done. In audio, you can have something where you can barely hear sounds, and when it's done, it can sound like our phone conversation.
Hmm. Just to kind of follow up on that for a second, one of the things I sort of, and Doug and I both talk about is that, the labs on the television shows are better funded than your local lab. Do law enforcement organizations have these abilities or the equipment that they'd need to do this, or let alone the trained personnel dedicated to doing it?
The problem they run into is this. There's very limited budgets in law enforcement, and actually most people have very limited budgets. So sometimes the best software is out of the reach. But the bigger problem is proper training. If you've got a lab that's in charge of doing DNA and video enhancement and all kinds of other types of processing, very little time is going to be spent on the art of audio and video enhancement. And therefore, even if you were properly trained, you're going to start to forget. And as new tools come out and updates come out, either the department has no budget to afford them, or they just don't have the time to be properly trained or remember their training, because you can also have turnover. And then what do you do? So the issue tends to be a multi-pronged one. It can be incredibly challenging. And so a lot of us in the industry, we actually donate to law enforcement and to innocence projects to help out, because we understand those challenges, and really it comes down to just caring about the truth.
That's great.
We've seen this where in both in reality and in fiction, both on the news and on the CSI, where if you see a person's face or license plate, like you talked about, an ATM image or some other surveillance camera, and they're able to enhance this, and we know that cases have been solved with that. But what if you don't have that kind of telling detail, that thing that would say, hey, this is the guy, this is the car? What else can you find from a video file that would help?
Well, there's a process called photogrammetry, where you're actually measuring the size of something. So is the object in his hand a gun, or what size is that case? Or I had one where after video enhancement, this guy was seen in a surveillance video at a movie theater. When video enhancement's done, you still can't see it clear enough to see if that's actually him coming through the doorway. But we can take the doorway, which is of known dimensions, and using photogrammetry, be able to exactly calculate how tall that person is. When the height measurement came out, that height measurement matched the height of the client and proved that that was their alibi, that they were at the movie theater, because it looked good enough, it looked close to them in the video, but now you also had this extra dimension. And videogrammetry will tell you the speed of something. So if you want to know if a traffic stop was legit, was the person actually speeding when the officer pulled them over? This would prove yes or no definitively. Or how fast someone is traveling, or how fast any other object might be moving. You can also geometric items and be able to tell where someone is positioned in a three-dimensional space, even though you're looking at it from a single camera, to know, are they where we think they are located?
Hmm. So after you do all this, and you get all this evidence and you work on the files that are given you, obviously, then it's got to enter into the legal system. And so what are the special considerations about taking this kind of evidence and presenting it in a courtroom?
Well, you have to make sure that you're following accepted science and accepted methods, and that it's replicatable. And all this means is that your peers could take what you've done and be able to reproduce what you did using provable real science. And there's a lot of junk science out there. And that usually means that what you're doing is you're working in a lossless format. In other words, you're working in ways where your compression, your codecs, don't discard any details, and you're documenting every step of what you're doing.
Okay.
So how can listeners who want to know more about doing this and maybe even become involved in the field, how can they learn what you know?
Well, by far the best thing to do is to belong to a group, a forensic group. For example, here in the U.S., the American Board of Recorded Evidence. I'm on that board. I find this to be a tremendous forum. Some of the biggest names are, and it's a collaborative group. All of them are. There's also the International Association for Identification, and there are other groups out there that cater to special sectors. And the idea behind all of them is to provide an educational outreach so that people who are trying to learn more and collaborate on the ideas have an opportunity. And you all have educational summits. I know that there's a digital forensic summit that's happening on August 7th and 8th at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And that one is going to have, I'm going to be one of the lecturers there, and it's going to have all the topics we talked about. It's going to provide people with a hands-on opportunity in workshops and give them a real understanding of the science behind each item and a chance to talk with the experts and the real nerds who do the coding as well to understand more about it. The other is getting software and playing with it. For audio, I recommend Adobe Audition. If that's outside your, the budget, there's Audacity, which is free. On the video side, there's some excellent programs. I'm a big fan of one called Video Cleaner, which is written by the open source community. I'm one of the programmers on the team, and it's completely free. It is now used by, I think, 13,000 people as of the time of this interview, and it's growing by 1,000 a month. And it's, I believe it's the world's most popular forensic video enhancement software. And I know that links to this, all of these items I just mentioned, will also be with the episode.
Exactly. Wait, you worked on the George Zimmerman case. And yes. How did you get involved in that, and what exactly did you do?
Well, I was... that was a highly charged case, and a lot of my peers actually chase after high-profile cases. I tend to stay away from them. I find them very polarizing, and it's also it usually leads to a certain amount of grandstanding in the media. I don't like doing that. I feel that my place is not to be in front of the camera. My place is to work the evidence and just quietly do what the evidence calls for. So I turned down requests originally to be part of this, but there was a video enhancement that was done by a place in Florida, and people started to use it to speculate whether or not there was a wound on the back of George Zimmerman's head. And they used enhancement, and you can tell it was enhancement because everything got thicker. All the lines got thicker, like someone drew them with a marker. And so I ran it through a restorative process, and it built back the details and provided a much clearer picture. And Matt Gutman opted to use it. And in fact, when I called him up and said, so is it going to be helpful to you? He says to me, it's going to be on GMA in 15 minutes. And I said, what's GMA? And he said, Good Morning America. And needless to say, that created quite a buzz for a while. It was definitely a lot of tension. Then he had it on Nightline. And to this day, it's the clearest evidence that's out there, and it was a real validation for the process, a restorative process versus an enhancement process. In fact, if the methods that are used in enhancement were submitted to the courts for the first time today, I doubt they'd ever get approved. They're only accepted because that's how it was always done. But a restorative process, also known as clarification, is much better because it leads to much clearer results, and it leads to one single reality in the end. It's not like someone's playing with the settings and this person makes it look like there's a wound and this other guy makes it look like it's not, like you can get with purely enhancement. It builds back those details, and the reality is the reality. And I'm often as surprised as the client. When the process is complete, I'll look at it and go, oh, wow, I can really see a difference. And I never know. It's like snowflakes. You just don't know what you're going to get till the process is done. And I find that quite intriguing.
So for people who are looking, you know, we obviously are living in a world of surveillance now. What for you is sort of the ideal, if somebody, using Doug's example earlier, if you can't mount your iPhone outside on your roof, what's sort of the ideal starting place? I'm sure obviously would be to have television cameras outside your home, right, 24/7, but for the average bear, what's sort of the ideal world?
Well, if are we talking about to capture a recording or to...
Right, yeah.
Well, these days, systems have gotten very inexpensive, and there's, like, Costco is a great source for finding inexpensive camera systems that are really good, and so is Amazon.com, and you can actually find superb systems for under a grand that are incredibly easy to put up, and they'll give you a great peace of mind. And it's very cheap insurance because not only does it provide you evidence of a crime that happens, but it also is a great deterrent to crime ever occurring when someone can see you have recording around a business or a home. And that's often the case, is that video is usually put up more as a deterrent. It's part of the reason why videos are so bad when I get them, because they weren't placed to really catch the guy. They were placed to be a visual deterrent. And so I'm now looking, and I can't see his face. I can only see that the guy needs Rogaine.
We have footage from a neighbor of someone wearing a sweatshirt with a hood up.
That's what we've been able to figure out.
Yeah.
I view crime the way other people, the way dentists view cavities. It's a shame, but where would business be without it?
Well, on that note, we're going to wrap this up. Doug, this is great. This is fascinating stuff, and we really appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
It was my pleasure, and thank you.
And, of course, we're going to have links up and all that on the website, so go there. There'll be other stuff to study and read up on this fascinating topic. And until next time, thanks for being with us.